All right, so it looks like the sound is coming in clear, so we can begin. So first of all, welcome to everybody joining in today for the Fulbright Scholar Alumni Hour. I'm very pleased to introduce the new cohort, part of the new cohort, of the Scholar Alumni Ambassadors. My name is Michelle Balorchi, and I'm an Outreach and Recruitment Specialist at the Institute of International Education based in Washington, D.C. And I have a good number of ambassadors with me today, a nice panel that we've set up, and you'll be meeting them shortly. Keep in mind that these are our new official representatives of the program. They are alumni who have recently returned from a Fulbright grant opportunity, and they are here to serve as a resource to you if you're an applicant, you're thinking about considering applying to the program, you have some questions about particular disciplines or the opportunities in the awards catalog. So consider our alumni ambassadors as a resource, as colleagues, peers that you can contact and confer with. So just a brief background about the Fulbright Scholar Program. We are gearing up to celebrate 75 years next year, so the program's been around for quite some time. We are partnered with 160 countries, and we are proud to offer scholarship and fellowship opportunities for a wide range of applicants, from students to scholars, faculty, professionals, lawyers, artists, journals, etc., to teach, research, or study abroad. And so there's quite a few opportunities available. Specifically, the Fulbright U.S. Scholar Program sends about 800 scholars and professionals abroad every year. The mission of the program is really to foster mutual understanding and to bring people from other cultures and countries together to ultimately improve lives around the world. And the program was established in 1946 by an act of Congress, and it is the flagship international educational and cultural exchange program of the U.S. government, and it is sponsored by the U.S. Department of State with generous funding from several of our partner countries around the world. And we at IIE administer the program, both for the student side of the program as well as the scholar side of the program. So lots of great opportunities. It certainly is a bilateral program in every sense. So when you apply and go to a country, you are representing the U.S. as kind of a cultural ambassador. The diversity and inclusion that we have developed the strategy with the State Department is very close to our outreach and recruitment strategy. This is a key component of everything that we do, and this statement comes directly from the U.S. Department of State. We strive to onboard a cohort of grantees every year that really reflect the diversity of the United States. So we try and keep the opportunities open to everyone, and everyone should feel that they are eligible to apply regardless of their background, their color, their race, their religion, etc. So whether they're disabled, any of those things, we have accommodations, and we look forward to having a very diverse and robust applicant pool and also a pool of grantees. Now, in terms of the alumni ambassadors who you're going to meet shortly, who are they? Well, they have recently returned in the past few years from a Fulbright grant, and through a very competitive application process, they have demonstrated impact in the field as well as upon their return to the U.S., whether at their institution, at their organization, in their career. And we train these ambassadors to speak about the program and to talk about their experiences and the impact that they have and the outcomes that they have experienced. They serve for 2 years as official representatives of the program, as well as present at conferences and campuses. And of course, now everything's virtual, so you might have more access to them on a virtual platform nowadays, since location is no longer a restriction. And the reason why we have this program, it's been around 10 years. We're now in our 11th year with the Alumni Ambassadors, and this is actually funding through IIE, not through the State Department. And this is really to not only enhance the diversity of applicants and grantees, but also to showcase the program, the impact of the Fulbright Scholar Program to encourage people like you to apply. And also they serve kind of as a brain trust for us on the outreach team here at IIE. We work with them to have a better understanding of what the needs are of scholars and faculty professionals so that we can really cater our messaging and our assistance and all of that to you so that they're kind of our ears and eyes on the ground. So alumni ambassadors serve a very key role, and they are also connected to leadership at the program, so we really value their input and their insights, and we're excited that we've recently onboarded them. They are brand new to their role, and this is one of the first opportunities for them to meet you and for you to meet them. So without further ado, I'm going to introduce our first ambassador, Heather Bandeen, and I'll let them go ahead and kind of go around and introduce themselves. Again, this is an informal opportunity for you to meet them. Feel free to chat in your questions in the question box. We will have some time at the end, and we'll kind of go around the room, so to speak, and hear from all of them. So, Heather?
Thanks so much, Michelle. It's nice to be here with you today. Thank you so much. I was honored to be a part of the Fulbright program back in 2014 and 15. My background is as a K-12 teacher, and then I was in community colleges working with teacher education, and now I work with local government. So back in 2014, I applied for a Roving Scholar of American Studies Fulbright in Norway. It is a wonderful opportunity to be based in Oslo, the capital city, and then you fly to a different school and city every single week. So I had a chance to meet hundreds of teachers across the country and work with thousands of students. It was a priceless opportunity as someone with a background as a teacher, interested in education policy, and having lived in different parts of the U.S. It drew me to the position I have now, which is working in local government, and I travel around the state of Minnesota. I work with appointed and elected officials all across the state of Minnesota, and prior to this, I was in my car, just like I was in Norway, traveling by boat and plane and train all over the country. I do that in Minnesota now. My project when I went to Norway was looking very much at the social and political policies that supported the profession of teaching, and having a chance to learn about the policies that structured public education in Norway, and then have a chance to listen to the stories and the teachers and the students from across the country, gave me access to just these beautiful pieces of qualitative data that led to wonderful publishing. And I actually had some colleagues from Norway come and stay with me in St. Paul, and they presented with me at some professional conferences. So the world has opened up to me having come back from Norway. I continue to communicate with my colleagues in Norway and in other countries as a result, and I bring that experience to my work with local government in Minnesota, and it has been priceless. The organization that supported this very special Fulbright in Norway was based in Halden, and it was the Norwegian Center for Foreign Languages and Education. Norway is the one country that has this particular Fulbright. You apply to either teach in high school or in middle school, and then they end up choosing three candidates to travel the country. So thank you, Michelle, and thank you to everyone who joined us today. Fulbright is amazing, and it has changed my life for sure.
Excellent. All right. So moving on, Gretchen Bauer.
Thank you very much. It's nice to be here with everyone today. And I'm a political scientist from the University of Delaware, the Department of Political Science and International Relations. And I thought Fulbright support for my third sabbatical leave in Africa, which was in the spring of 2016. And I had been working in Southern Africa primarily for a couple of decades in Namibia and Botswana, and really wanted to transition to West Africa and saw this as an opportunity. And after having had two self-funded sabbaticals, I was also looking for the generous support that Fulbright provides. And that's something that I would be happy to speak more about. I also wanted the opportunity to teach at an African university, which I hadn't done in a formal capacity yet, and was looking forward to engaging with a very notable community of accomplished scholars at the University of Ghana. I was teaching at the Legon Center for International Affairs and Diplomacy, which is primarily graduate students, MA and PhD students, some of whom are going to be diplomats for the government of Ghana, and others of whom are just interested in that topic. And then I was doing research through the Center for Gender Studies and Advocacy. And the director of that center, whom I did know beforehand, is a good friend of mine, and she has become my research collaborator. And since my Fulbright in 2016, we published three pieces together, and we have an ongoing research agenda focused on women's political leadership in Africa. So that's the research that we do. I've returned many, many times to Ghana since my Fulbright. I've taught at another university in Ghana, also to graduate students in an international relations MA program. Another thing that I did, which I think is quite important, was to establish a study abroad program at the University of Delaware for Delaware undergraduates to return to Ghana. And I think, you know, we all agree that there are so many misconceptions and stereotypes about Africa that it's very good to get our American students over there. I was also able to return in the fall of 2019 as a fellow at a newly established Center for Advanced Studies at the University of Ghana, Legon. So it was a wonderful opportunity. I really appreciate it, and I would be very happy to help anybody with an application.
Excellent. And Gretchen, the two women featured in the photo, you said one of them was a former government minister and BBC correspondent. Is that correct?
Right. So the one on the right is my research collaborator, who I mentioned, Akosia Darkwa, professor, head of the sociology department. And the other one is Elizabeth Ohene, who people may recognize as a BBC correspondent. She was also a cabinet minister in a previous government. And we were doing a study on women cabinet ministers last summer.
Excellent. Very nice. Great. All right, moving on. Donathan Brown.
All right. Well, hi, everyone. I'm Donathan Brown. I had an excellent grant year, 2016 to 2017, at the University of Maribor in Maribor, Slovenia. If, like many people I talk to about Slovenia, you have to point it out to folks on the map. Oftentimes, their recollection of where Slovenia is actually where Slovakia is, or whatever the case may be. It's always a fun time engaging in that map conversation. So in my current role, I'm assistant provost and assistant vice president at the Rochester Institute of Technology, as my shirt suggests. And I had a fascinating project of teaching at the undergraduate and graduate level, understanding race in American politics. For me, this was very important, understanding that in that part of the region, American studies is a very robust and dynamic discipline. But for me, I wanted to take on a particular challenge in the sense that I wanted to introduce race in American politics in a department and to students that had very little familiarity with the concept of race and racism, particularly within the American context. I think one of the most fascinating aspects about my Fulbright was that my students openly admitted that their perceptions of the United States were largely influenced by MTV. And so, take that for whatever it's worth, but just know that it was a series of fascinating conversations, to say the least. One thing I will say about my grant period is that you talk about a warm welcome. Wow. The pictures that you see here on the slide really just encapsulate a very small portion. From having the opportunity to not only teach at the collegiate level, but also to teach at a local high school. That was a fascinating experience, teaching those students about American colleges and universities and the difference between their system of higher education versus ours in the United States. But long story short, I am still engaged with the University of Maribor and the Department of English and American Studies. We held an international conference in Maribor, I want to say 2018 or 19, it all blends together. We're still in research collaborations right now. So a lot of great things and a lot of great reasons to apply. So I'll end it on that note.
Excellent. Thank you, Donathan. And you mentioned that you had the opportunity to teach at the high school level. Was that something that you had envisioned prior to the grant, or was that something that, how did that come about?
No, I had no sort of, interest in teaching at the high school level, but it was requested from me, and I decided, why not? And it was the best thing I could do. Again, being flexible, being open to new things and new experiences really led to a hilarious hour of 30 students all thinking and telling you what they know about the United States, which on the most half was wrong. So it was just by invitation only, so to speak, but it was a great experience.
Excellent. Sounds exactly like a Fulbright experience. That's what we aim is to kind of bring those cultures together and have them understand exactly, you know, from an American, more about what America's all about. Great. Amy Forrest.
Hi, thanks, Michelle. Appreciate it. I'm Amy Forrest. I had a little trouble when I was getting out today, so I'm actually using my phone. So if anyone can't hear me, go ahead and put it in the chat. I can turn up my phone a little bit louder, but I'm talking with you from Omaha, Nebraska. I am a community college professor, and I teach at Metropolitan Community College, which is in Omaha. There's three other Metropolitan Community Colleges in the United States, so I always have to say it's the one in Omaha. To give you a little bit of background on me, I kind of have a long, convoluted story getting to Fulbright. I can elaborate on it later, but to begin with, I was a non-trad, a non-traditional student, and I graduated with my doctorate fairly late. I decided to stay home and have my family first, so I have a lot of children and a lot of grandchildren, and by the time I was exposed to the delights of Fulbright, I was in my 40s, and by the time I decided to apply for it, it was 2012. My first time out, I did not get accepted. I was actually the alternate, and I allowed myself about a day to pout and got over it and then reapplied, and I was accepted for the 2013-2014 college. I was only interested in one country, Hungary, because I am half Hungarian and I'd never been home per se. And so I applied to a teacher's training college. It's actually Kecskemét College, which no one knows where Kecskemét is, but I always tell everyone it was about 50 miles south of Budapest. And that everyone says, oh, I know that one. So kind of like Donovan, you have to get out the map and show people where it is. I also had a unique experience similar to Donovan's where the college that they wanted me to teach at, the Kecskemét College, was really excited that I was a community college professor because they said, well, we kind of need a Jane of all trades here. And so they were very interested in my PhD being in African American history, and they said, we've got to have you teach African American history, which I thought was really odd in a Hungarian setting, but actually when I got there, I found out why they wanted me there so much. And then they asked, can you also do conversational English, and can you do American literature? And I said, sure, we're going to do this from an historic point of view because I'm an historian. And they were fine with that. So we did a little bit of give and take. I ended up teaching six different courses, and it was to the college staff, to the college students, and then I ended up with first graders. That was a unique experience. The Kecskemét Teachers Training College was a very unique place in the fact that it was a college, but it had an elementary school literally within its doors. So the students who were going to school for pre-K education or for elementary ed teaching were actually going to classes with various professors in the morning, and then in the afternoon they went and actually taught real-life students. So I think that the United States, we need to be doing this model because I was very impressed with what I was seeing, and it worked really well. I've heard from several of my students, yay for Facebook, who have gotten jobs since, so they've kept in touch with me. I would say that since my return, for what I've learned in the classroom, I am just in the process of finishing the last revisions on a book that I've been writing. It's about using material culture in the classroom, because I learned with my students, many of whom were in classrooms that literally just had a chalkboard and one piece of chalk. I learned that in an ESL classroom, because my project was basically TESOL, teaching English to speakers of other language, and in an ESL Hungarian classroom, a little bit of a mouthful, that you have to teach with big gestures and lots of visuals. And so even though my Hungarian was lousy and their English was much better, we actually got through and enjoyed, and I had a wonderful time with them. Since I've returned, I've also been doing peer review with Fulbright for applications, and I was really honored when the Hungarian American Fulbright Commission got a hold of me and said, do you mind looking at our applications and helping us out as well? So I feel like I made a lot of special friendships, which I am still keeping up with my students and with staff. Thank you.
Great, Amy. So I think we all have, based on your experience, the F in Fulbright stands for flexibility, it seems, because you had first graders to college students. So, and I think that's great. I think what that shows, and I think the same that Donathan experienced, when you go to institutions that have never had a Fulbrighter or never or seldom have an American, right, come to their campus, they then want to tap into you for everything, because for them, you are the expert, right, on American society. Oops. We're getting some feedback, but so I think that's great. I think demonstrating that flexibility and showing that interest in helping them have a better understanding, that's really what Fulbright's all about. So thank you so much. Moving on to Kimberly Jackson.
Hi, I hope everyone can hear me. I've been having some phone difficulty. Okay,
yep,
good.
Yep,
great. Well, thank you, Michelle, and thank you to the Fulbright committee for having me on today. I'm actually at Spelman College. I am chair of chemistry and biochemistry, and I'm associate professor of biochemistry. I actually went to Antigua and Barbuda, the lovely island of Antigua, and I chose to go to Antigua because I'm a third generation West Indian living on the mainland. And I wanted to give that experience to my children as well. So if you look at the picture on the top right, the kids dressed in uniforms, those are my three kids that went with me on the trip. I hope they were happy, but I think they were. And so I'll be able to share more for those who are thinking about taking their families on a Fulbright. I can share more about that with you. But while I was there, I was at Antigua State University, where I taught biochemistry, a level one biochemistry, which they actually take before they go to the main university, the University of the West Indies in Barbados. And so there I created a project called Communicating Chemistry Through the Local Cuisine. So to help with science at Antigua State, I was able to develop a curriculum using food as their model for doing their science experiments, because they have problems sometimes getting scientific items onto the island. And so if you see a couple of pictures, I'm there with the students making ice cream, where we're able to talk about the freezing point of depression and the biomolecule of water. At the end of my 6 months in Antigua, I took them all out to a restaurant, and we took a picture. So this particular opportunity allowed me to come back to Spelman and give this type of global grounding to an international program with our food studies program. I'm the director of that program and one of the founders. And so now with that program, because I knew I could internationalize a program in Antigua, I can now do one with our students in Italy. So if you have questions about being a black woman in science traveling to an international country, if you have questions about taking your family, you know, it was three, four, my husband would come on occasion, if you have questions about teaching in an international country, you know, I'm the one to talk to. Thank you.
Excellent. Thank you, Kim. So I think the students in your class felt lucky to have you because they got to have a tasty product at the end of the session there with the ice cream, right?
Yeah, and some of them actually, you know, they added, Oreos, and some of the, I think it's something called sorrel, which is in the Caribbean, some type of flour, so they were able to add their own flavors to the ice cream as well.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure they're anxious to have you back. Local cuisine class always sounds nice. All right. Moving on, Courtney Welton Mitchell.
Hi, well, thank you so much for the opportunity. Can everyone hear me?
Great. Yes.
So I'm actually speaking to you all from Denver, Colorado. I'm affiliated with the Colorado School of Public Health at the Anschutz Medical Campus, but my background is actually as a social psychologist with a mental health and gender-based violence expertise as well. And so I've done a lot of intervention development research, and so I had the opportunity to essentially apply for a Fulbright after I had already secured a grant from the U.S. State Department. So I was traveling back and forth to Malaysia, working with a local human rights organization on a grant on empowering stateless Rohingya to prevent intimate partner abuse. So we did a community-designed public health campaign designed to change attitudes and promote help-seeking. And we were able to set that up with an RCT. So this was actually a two-year project. And I thought if I could apply for a Fulbright, it would allow me to expand the scope of my work, not only beyond the human rights organization and the Rohingya community members I was working with, but to pull in a broader university network, and also to physically relocate with my family. So I took my wife and my 7-year-old daughter, and we were based in Penang, where I was situated at the University of Science Malaysia and the Gender Research Institute. And that's an interdisciplinary research institute. So this was a great opportunity to really connect with an interdisciplinary group of both faculty and students and pull them into the existing research initiative, and also to broker partnerships between university stakeholders and those that are working on migrant rights and other human rights issues in the community, and really share expertise. Where a lot of the human rights organizations had expertise working with communities, they didn't necessarily have research expertise, whereas those at the university have the research expertise. So I was very fortunate to be a part of this process. In this photo here, you can see this is me with some of the team members from Tenaganita, and that's an Indonesian colleague, Malaysian colleagues, and Rohingya colleagues, as well as a colleague from the U.S. as well. And I think working in these sort of nuanced and complex networks, I realized that there were so many rich possibilities, and while I definitely feel like I was able to bring things to the table and contribute, I certainly learned as much and benefited as much from those I was working with in terms of what they were able to teach me. You know, I've continued to have relationships with those that I met and worked with in Malaysia. Some of my Rohingya colleagues are actually resettled to Houston, Texas, and we're working together on a new research initiative. I've had colleagues as guest lecturers for the courses I teach at the School of Public Health, where I teach a series that is focused on international disasters and global humanitarianism. And I think on a personal level, you know, my partner is certainly very much enjoyed the experience and developed, I think, what will be lifelong partnerships. But more than that, my daughter, it has just been so wonderful to see how it really opened her eyes and changed her worldview. And even before the COVID-19 pandemic, she was able to keep in regular touch with the friends that she made in Malaysia. And since the pandemic, she's actually, you know, increased the contact that she has with her friends and even former teachers in Malaysia, I guess because she's become so, you know, she's adapted to the online reality that is the situation for many of us these days. But I look forward to continued opportunities to work with this broad network that I was fortunate to be a part of. And I think that, you know, having this unique opportunity to add the Fulbright to an existing grant just brought a layer of richness to the experience in so many ways that it's really hard to articulate. But I'm happy to speak to anyone who's interested in doing something similar, and also people who are, you know, trying to navigate bringing their family abroad and what that's like, and some of the inherent challenges with that.
Great. Thank you, Courtney. I think you bring up a good point about combining funding. So we often get questions from applicants who say, look, you know, I've got a little bit of, you know, a little pot of money to access, but I'd like to combine it with the Fulbright. Is that possible? And the answer is absolutely. We would just ask that you provide documentation as to what exactly you are receiving. But it is certainly possible to combine Fulbright with other funding, and I think you also bring up an excellent point that the other funding is one thing, it's great, but Fulbright provides a platform, it provides a network, it provides all these opportunities to engage, and so I think this is something great for our applicants to consider that, you know, we understand that our funding sometimes alone doesn't suffice or doesn't equate to replacing your salary, so please do talk to us and we can let you know how other campuses or institutions might handle that, and whether you could also seek out additional funding. So thank you, Courtney. All right, and then last but not least, David Wirth.
Thank you very much, Michelle. It's a privilege to be on a panel with such distinguished colleagues. As I've been listening to all the other presentations, I've been trying to think of what I might say that could add to the excellent contributions that have already been made. One thing that I think hasn't been discussed that much is the application process. So maybe I can share with you a bit of my somewhat convoluted application experience. Like other colleagues who have been speaking to you today, I had a sabbatical coming up, and I had always been aware of the Fulbright program. I, in fact, had a prior partial Fulbright and was scanning through the list. I work in the field of environment, sustainable development, and climate. Most of the people that I have always, whenever I have had a sabbatical on the infrequent occasions before, I've wanted to get out and do work in the real world as opposed to sitting in an ivory tower. Most of the people that work in my field that go abroad were working in China. So I looked at a potential award there. And then I came across the award, which is called Distinguished Chair in Sustainability at the Higher School of Economics in Moscow. I certainly don't consider myself distinguished in first chair, and probably the last that I'll ever have. But it was a vehicle to get me to Moscow and to take advantage of what I think is a significant opportunity. One thing, if you're looking at a variety of awards, in retrospect, I could see that the China opportunity was less desirable because it was a funnel that then would send people off to different institutions. This award, by contrast, was at a particular institution for a particular subject matter. So that's one thing to look at, to keep in mind when you're looking at different awards, the match between what you're interested in doing and the application process. Maybe I shouldn't say this on a call like this, but my application process was very rushed. I think I did it in several days, and I just barely squeaked in under the deadline. One thing I would suggest you do, which is actually helpful to you as an applicant, is to negotiate a letter of invitation. That was an occasion to actually engage in a discussion with the institution about what they wanted me to do and what I could bring to the table. Now, that having been said, I would echo some of the comments made by colleagues on this presentation, and when I actually got there, it turned out to have no relationship whatsoever to what had been pre-negotiated. The vice rector with whom I had, who had signed the letter, had left. The head of the law faculty who had supported the letter had moved on to something else, and her replacement was interested in something very different. So basically, we managed to make it work out. As in many other disciplines, the sense is that, well, if you're a law professor, you can teach law, regardless of what it is. So we managed to negotiate an appropriate program for me that met their needs as well as mine. I was actually advised by somebody who's already at the institution, an American, who said, don't hold the line. Don't say yes until there's something that meets everybody's needs. So I found it very, very rewarding to go through that process. There was an option, which I think also there's some broader learning here. This particular grant is either a research or a teaching grant or a mixture of the two. If you have a choice, I would suggest opting for teaching opportunities. You know, I saw many other people, the Russia Fulbright program is very large, and I think those who were involved with teaching had a much more rewarding experience. So I had a teaching and a research grant. I am still in touch with my students. I am working with one who's now a PhD candidate. I'm also in touch with my colleagues. I'm going to be teaching an online course there this spring through the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts, where I also have an appointment. So the teaching opportunities, I think, are especially well-suited to, not uniquely, but especially well-suited to creating those kinds of ongoing connections. Let's see what else I can tell you. I think the other thing is support from one's home institution. I frankly could not have taken this award. The picture that you see is actually taken from my balcony in Moscow, unbelievably. That's the actual view. It's not doctored. And Moscow is an expensive city, and I probably couldn't have done this without support from my home institution. My Boston College has a policy of topping up people's salaries on sabbatical if they have a Fulbright because of the prestigious nature of the award. I'll be glad to talk to anybody about that or anything else to follow up. So maybe that's enough for now. I would also just note that the post-Fulbright experience, apart from my working with a PhD student whom was in a master's program when I was there, and also working with a colleague and teaching a course together, the post-Fulbright experience has also introduced me to Kimberly Jackson. Who's on this call today. I was originally trained as a chemist and am very interested in her work because if things go well, I can fold it into my course on the International Law of Food. So the Fulbright experience is, it pays to put some time and effort into the upfront experience. Frankly, I think the preparation of the application is not as burdensome as one might think. It's more the thought that goes into it. And the Fulbright experience is one that keeps on giving indefinitely into the future. Thank you.
Excellent. Thank you, David. Excellent. So we've done the round robin. You've got to meet all the alumni ambassadors, and we've actually got a good number of questions, and we have more than 100 people on the call. So, and I know that we did set this for an hour, so it puts us with 20 minutes left, but if we can't get to everyone, you're welcome to stay on. We'll try and go maybe just 10 or 15 minutes extra to accommodate. So let me just move on to the next slide, and then we can start taking some questions. I wanted to share these slides because there are more pictures from our ambassadors. So some of you hit on your path to Fulbright, but are there any other, would anybody like to volunteer any other things as to what they considered before putting an application in? So we heard a little bit from David, but Donathan or Gretchen or Courtney or any of you, would you like to quickly touch on that, and then we'll open it up to the questions?
Sure, I'd be happy to.
Great.
So I want to also reinforce something that someone else said, which is that I got this
this was the third, well, I had a student Fulbright when I was doing my dissertation research in the early 1990s in Namibia, but that was a long time ago. And in between, I had applied two times for an African regional research Fulbright, which I did not receive. And so I consider this one then my third try. And so that's one thing that I would also like to mention is that, you know, it could be that you may not get it the first time you apply, but keep on trying. I think that's very important. And then also I would agree that that letter of invitation is very important. And I actually went personally to Ghana to get my letter of invitation. And when I arrived in the Department of Political Science at the University of Ghana, the department had told me that I was the fourth person who came looking for a letter of invitation. And so I did not affiliate with his department. There was, in fact, another Fulbright there while I was there. And I went to the other unit that I mentioned, LESIA, Legon Center for International Affairs and Diplomacy. And another point I would like to raise, but I'll just throw it out there and maybe come back to it later, is, you know, another wonderful aspect of the Fulbright is your cohort, so the other Fulbrights who are there with you. And I could, you know, tell a story or two about them, but I will let others talk about the application process.
Sure. Anybody else then a couple thoughts about this?
Yeah, this is Kimberly. I would like to make a point. So when I was applying, I thought heavily about my children, being children of color, and where would we go? Because, you know, race relations are not that good all over the world. And so it was a challenging decision. We made the decision as a family because I had originally looked into another institution, another country, and they were having poor race relations. And that's just something I did not want my children to undergo. So that was one of the many factors that we were in a country where it was perceived that the majority of people were people of color. And so that was one of the reasons that we chose Antigua and Barbuda.
Great. Any other thoughts? All right. Moving on. David mentioned a couple of great points. Are there any other, we've gotten some questions about how you all selected your host institution. So Gretchen, you actually physically flew out there and introduced yourself. What about applicants who don't have that luxury or who aren't familiar with the particular country or the institution, and the application or the award is open to all disciplines, all projects, and they have an idea for a project. Were any of you in that position where this was your first experience in that particular place?
I'd like to address that one.
Sure.
I had not been to Hungary before. I had no family living there anymore. So what I did was I looked at catalogs. Then I went to the host institution. They do put like a little blurb what they would like from you. And it's not like the want have, but I did look through and say, okay, would that fit me? Would they fit me? Would I fit them? So what I did was is I emailed, and then when I had someone who I was interested in, we went ahead and we Skyped. And that really helped because then we had a very quick kind of an interview, how is this going to work? I didn't go to Ghana, but it was really helpful to be able to do that.
Great, and I think more and more people are open to having, you know, Skype calls or Zoom calls, so it's something that goes beyond an email, and I think you can hammer out, you know, kind of an agreement, negotiate all of that, so that you have more of a robust invitation letter, and that's something that we always recommend, even if it's optional or preferred. If you have that invitation letter, it speaks volumes about not only the interest by, you know, from the host, but also the feasibility and the suitability of what you plan to do. So there's some buy-in. Anybody else would like to share their experience? I know, Heather, you were all over Norway, so but that one I don't think requires an invitation. Is that correct?
No, it didn't require a letter of invitation, but the one thing that I did, which I didn't remember until Amy started talking, was I talked to some former Fulbrighters. So a lot of the roving scholars in Norway have these fantastic blogs. So I looked them up and I talked to a handful of them to see if they liked it. And one of them actually taught at Augsburg University here in the Twin Cities. And so we met for dinner, and that was wildly helpful. So those early relationships really can shape where you feel like you fit in Fulbright, for sure.
Great. No, that's an excellent point. Anybody else? All right. One more slide, and then we've got lots of questions to get to. And I think we're going to get to a lot of these. There's some questions that kind of relate directly to this. And here we see a picture of Donathan. Donathan, was this kind of a host family experience, or what was that?
Yeah, most certainly. I refer to him as my second family there. So that was us just having kind of a Sunday snack there.
Okay, great. And David, these were your law students, is that correct, at the bottom? Oh, you're muted.
Yes, I'm sorry. I had forgotten about this picture. I'm the short one in the middle. This was the opening welcome event at Gorky Park.
Okay.
They had handed out what I guess they thought was the way lawyers should be dressed, with judicial wigs, as if I was coming from the UK. So,
I see. Okay. Interesting. Great. Well, thank you all, and we're going to now move on to the Q&A because we've got lots to get through. So I'm going to actually start with you, David. We had a question from someone who's a law professor applying to an award, and they are having some, you know, the confusion about the syllabi to provide. So they could be potentially teaching undergraduates or graduates. Do you have any advice on putting the syllabi? And actually, Amy, you also taught. Donathan, you also taught. So those of you that were in the classroom, what advice would you give on syllabi?
Since the question was addressed directly to me, I think that that's something that where, again, one can use the letter of invitation as a helpful vehicle. I think it's, as opposed to viewing it as a hurdle or an impediment, it's an occasion for actually discussing what your host institution would like you to do. In the area of law, all of us in the United States teach graduate students. In almost every other portion of the world, the law is an undergraduate discipline, so one has to keep that in mind in putting together the curriculum. On the other hand, I actually ended up teaching in a master's program on international economic law. So I don't know that I can pluck just the right answer out of the air for the questioner. I think it's something that would benefit from being pre-negotiated in advance. Then you have the benefit of your host institution having some buy-in with you in particular, even if, as one of the other presenters said, there may be more than one letter of invitation that's extended.
Right, and specifically, David, and for the rest of you as well, did you, if it was a course that you hadn't taught before but was requested by the host, did you then create a syllabus just for that particular course and include that in the application?
The answer is yes, in the sense that no matter how pre-negotiated the situation is, it's still kind of a best guess. And I can tell you that given that I was proposing to teach in the international economic curriculum, I was talking to one of my students at the time of Boston College, who happened to be an international student from Georgia, and I said, oh, well, here's how I'm putting together the syllabus for this particular course. And he was very interested and was talking to me about it. And then I said, well, so that the Russian students would have something familiar to look at, I put in the UCAS arbitration, which is extraordinarily controversial in Russia. And he said, oh, you can forget getting that award. So it still worked out. So I wouldn't be too particular about it, but to the extent that you can have any advance information about what to aim at, you're probably better off.
Great. Anybody else in terms of the syllabi?
Yeah, I would just say in my situation, it was best described as a roving conversation. What we discussed initially may not have been the end result. of our conversation. So upon arrival, the opportunity was presented to teach a course we haven't discussed previously. And so F, standing for flexibility within Fulbright, I said, sure, why not? And so a lot of things began to develop the week or two as soon as I arrived. So as much as planning that went into it at the very beginning, let's just say it didn't necessarily materialize in a way that I assumed it would at the end.
Great. Yeah, and I think it speaks to also, you know, being in one place and, you know, the host is in another country and you're not able to, unless you hop on a Skype call and really have that connection, you're just kind of putting something to, it's a plan, it's a proposal, but you have to keep in mind, and this relates to the next question about flexibility, that things will not always pan out to the T from what, you know, what you put in that proposal. So could any of you else speak about how we heard from Amy and how she was kind of all over and deployed here and there and everywhere, but were any of you confronted with a situation where either the U.S. Embassy or the Commission said, hey, we'd love to have you speak at this conference, or can you do this, or your host put in a request, we'd love you to, you know, do that, you know, were there any situations where you said, oh, yeah, I didn't plan on it, but can do?
I can speak to that. I think that tolerating ambiguity, being flexible, being adaptable is really key. Having a contingency plan, backups, you know, not assuming, for example, that, you know, for example, my colleague at the Gender Research Institute, the director, was always so busy that often I had to come up with ideas and, you know, implement them in her absence, and then later would get feedback from her. And that worked out fine, but, you know, the expectation that I'd be meeting with her regularly or that she'd be available or other things, I think, you know, I was ready to sort of pivot and to make decisions on the fly, so to speak. And I ended up, although I was there for research, you know, at the university, I ended up presenting at conferences, at workshops, even when asked within 48 hours, you know, 24 hours notice, I ended up facilitating a journal club where we discussed research and a series of research seminars. And I was always pleased when they asked me for something specific and eager to jump in, even if it was a little disorienting, because sometimes, you know, maybe again, these are, you know, some cultural differences around planning and expectations and, you know, notification in advance before something comes up. So, you know, I used to teach a course for graduate students preparing them for international internships, and I was often reflecting on my own advice about being adaptable and being willing to sort of, you know, meet people where they needed you to be, if that makes sense.
Great, absolutely. All right, let's actually move on. We have lots to get through. So this is a great question, I think, and Gretchen, you kind of hit on it. So we do often, you know, a lot of people have applied to the program, they didn't get it the first time, and the question is, when you reapplied, did you put in the same application, or if not, what did you alter? How did you make, you know, what did you do differently to make it work?
Yeah, so that's a great question. And in my case, you know, those two that I did not get were something called the African Regional Research Program or something like that. There were very few of them, and it was for the whole continent. I don't know if they even still have them. But when I applied for the one to Ghana, I was applying to the Teaching Research Scholar program. And so it was a different program. And, you know, I'm not sure what the difference was, if that alone was the difference, or, you know, maybe I had a better letter of invitation, or I was by then more senior in my field, or it was just karma. But I do think that, you know, one should think very carefully about, you know, how maybe you fit the type of program that you're applying to. And, you know, David mentioned sort of, I don't know,
I don't want to be putting words in your mouth, throwing an application together or something like that. I mean, I feel like I spent a lot more time on it, right? That it really was something that I wanted to devote a lot of, thought and attention to. You want good letters, letters of recommendation from colleagues, right? Those are also part of the application process. Colleagues here in the States, yeah, and then I think a good, if you are applying for a teaching research program, a good research proposal is also good, and maybe one that's of interest to your host institution, or at least someone or some people at your host institution. Because, you know, I think that's something to keep in mind as well. I think oftentimes we're kind of accepted stateside, but then the universities overseas are the ones who are making the decisions. And so you need to have a champion there, if you can, who's going to kind of vouch for you in the selection process over there.
What Gretchen was saying, that letter of invitation is super important. The first time I applied, I did not have one. The second time, I first reached out to the Fulbright officer and said, what can I do to improve this? Then I found someone in my community here, and I said, may I look at your proposal, your application? And she said, on one condition, as long as you pay it forward, and the next time somebody asks you for one, you share it, which I have several times since, because that really helped me a great deal. And the letter invitation, it made my proposal actually be doable. It wasn't just some fantasies that I had, and it helped nail down what I was supposed to be doing in the classroom. The other thing is that application, I can't stress giving yourself enough time. It probably took me about 3 months, and I completely rewrote the application the second time from what I had turned in. It gave the people giving me references plenty of time to be able to think about it. It gave the college time to write that letter of invitation and get all the right signatures on it. Especially in Hungary, I was surprised at, even though they haven't been communist since 1989, the level of protocol that they each had to go through and getting the exact signatures on them. So it gave me enough time to get everything into place. I was still really scared, though, and did not expect it the second time.
All right. Okay, so moving along, we have a question for Kim. Kimberly, how old were your children when they were on the grant with you, and how did they adjust? If you could speak a little bit about that.
Yeah, so my kids were, and I'm trying to remember the ages. I know one was 15, one may have been 11, one was 10. And so they all had temper tantrums before we left because someone was going to miss their prom, somebody was going to miss a band trip to Disney World, like we hadn't gone to Disney World 50 million times. So there were all of these, you know, and I think it was just a nervousness, but they got there and we enrolled them in a private school, so I did a lot of background research before I got there, whether it was an international baccalaureate school or a private school, are what they consider government schools, but we ended up with the private school, and it worked out in their favor, and they had the time of their lives. They adjusted. They took a bus to school. There were kids in our neighborhood that went to school with them, and so it worked out well, and I think the reason it worked out well was because I did a lot of legwork before we got there. I made sure that we stayed in a gated community. I made sure I didn't want to disrupt really what they really did on a day-to-day basis here in the States. I did, but I didn't. I didn't want it to be too far removed, but I still wanted it to be fun and interesting.
Great. All right. Courtney, we have a question for you. Could you speak a bit about the feasibility of an intervention research project over the duration of the grant? So how that worked.
So the project that I was working on was a multi-stage project, so it was actually four phases, and the intervention phase was probably about 14 months and the Fulbright was 10 months and I extended a little bit. So if you think about it in the context of that one piece, it would be feasible over the course of 10 months, depending on your project, to actually implement it. But my suggestion would be thinking about the time required to make sure, for example, a lot of what we do is adaptation of intervention to the cultural context. So we do exploratory, initial pilot testing and other things. Thinking about if you have a research partner on the ground, is there a way that some of that work can be taking place already? Because once you sort of truncate the research process that for me was 2 years into 10 months, you would really be, you know, perhaps missing something. So I was trying to be strategic in terms of the timing, though, and it did fit almost exactly with that specific intervention phase. So I think it's doable if you're not quite as ambitious as well. I mean, I had a large project with a substantial amount of additional funding and a large team, but I can imagine a smaller variant of that as well that could have been completed in a shorter time frame.
All right. Great. We have another question. I think this was geared towards Amy when you said you taught 6 classes. So the question is, what was your work week like? How many hours did you put in? And did you spend quite a bit of hours in the classroom? And so just sharing a little bit about how that all worked.
It was not as bad as it sounds. And first of all, because I'm a community college professor, I'm used to it. But these were 45-minute classes, and they were fairly staffed. Normally, I have my Fridays clear, which I do in the States, which is very nice. I would say I probably did more work before I got into the classroom because 5 out of the 6 were brand new. So I was scrambling a little bit, but kind of like what David said, that syllabus really saved me because we kind of nailed it through before I started. And the students, I asked their input, how is this working for you, just like I do with my students here. And we kind of rearranged a little bit. For instance, I had a class of students. It was conversational English. I had 18 young ladies. And they really want to know about America. And again, I didn't really have very much in the classroom. So I said, okay, we're going to do a little history lesson here, but have some fun with it. We're going to go ahead and do a bridal shower. That was fascinating because they didn't know about American topics. What do you do? What games do you play? Why are people playing those? It's so odd. You know, and then I had them put together some images of what their dress would look like. And, I mean, I could not have done that in a classroom if I had any males with me. I suppose I could have maybe. I think sex is fair, but you adapt. The same thing with the first graders. I kind of looked at lesson plans, but worked when didn't. It actually worked very well having those 6 classes. I was really challenged. But I also was able to get away. I did travel on the weekends. I volunteered at the American Corners in Hungary, and I gave some lectures on my own. I just did some on the First Ladies because I was surprised at how many Hungarians were fascinated by American First Ladies. They didn't care a whit about the president. They wanted to hear about the women. I thought, hey, that's good with me. So things dovetailed. I very pleasantly surprised. When I first heard about the 6 classes, I thought, how am I going to do this? But, you know, it worked, and it worked well.
Great. Thanks, Amy. Next question is for David, and I know that we're about 5 minutes over, but if you're all okay, we'll stick on for another 5-10 minutes. And I do want to point out to the audience that this is recorded, and we will archive it, and all of our ambassadors, their emails are provided here, so I'm hoping it's okay. David, we have a lot of questions for you, so if we can't get to all of the questions geared to David, please do email him, and he will try and reply. But the question is, David, from someone who says, having worked and studied in Russia, they frequently encountered people who might not have understood the program or had some misunderstanding about the program. So did you encounter any of that, and can you How did you explain your reason for coming on the grant or coming through Fulbright?
First of all, I'm more than happy to answer all questions. So please do write to me, and I'll be glad to respond. I'm sorry, I'm not sure I entirely understand the question. Is it how I was received in Moscow, or how I was
Right, as a Fulbrighter through this kind of American-sponsored program, now being in Russia, were there any misconceptions about what your role was there as a Fulbrighter, et cetera?
Well, I mean, the answer is perhaps under some circumstances. I mean, I had to follow up on comments that others have made, I actually went out of my way to seek out speaking engagements. I must have had 6 or 8 in the year that I was there at relatively high-profile institutions, including the University in St. Petersburg. I was working in an area that is turns out is quite controversial in Russia, namely climate change. So that there seemed to be some eye-raising as to, is this guy speaking on behalf of the United States government? Is this guy a scholar? Is he something else that we don't really understand? I mean, I have a background in the region and the country going all the way back to the communist period, so I just kind of elided all of those and didn't pay too close attention to them. So my suggestion would be if there's a concern about that, don't worry about it too much. I mean, if you were to go back and look at the speaking engagements, one was at what's called the American Center in the embassy, which required Russian citizens to come in and clear both Russian security and U.S. security to come to my presentation, which is certainly set a certain atmosphere about what the nature of this presentation was. So I just tried to clear it up as much as I could. Just one point, though, when at my home institution, there was absolutely no question but that I was a scholar. And everything was kept on an absolutely scholarly plane. There wasn't any inquiry into my politics. I was there during not only speaking about climate change, but also during the election. And so I didn't raise these issues any more than they needed to be, and all of my colleagues were absolutely scrupulous about it. It's when you get out and when I got a little bit further away from my home institution that there might have been some questions, but it didn't bother me.
Great. Thank you, David. We have a couple of questions that were geared towards Heather and Gretchen, so I'm just going to go back for the audience. They're very specific, so feel free to note down the ambassador's email contact. It's at the bottom of the screen here. So, for example, let me just go back. Heather's is listed here, and Gretchen is on the next page. So for those of you that ask specific questions about applying for the Roving Scholar or getting affiliation in Ghana, please do reach out to them. Great. So let's see. I think we've just got a couple we've been through. I think this is a good way to end. Somebody asked, how would you respond to the question, if I had to do it all over again, I would choose to do X differently? So I think we'll make that our last question and we'll go around to all of you. Go ahead. Oh, I think you're on. Yeah.
Sorry. That's very easy for me, and if I had to do it over again, I would go for a year and not just a semester, without a doubt. There are reasons that I didn't, but absolutely that's what I would do differently.
Great. Who's next? Who'd like to go next?
I'm going to concur there with Gretchen. You know, when I left Nebraska, I was crying on the plane thinking, oh my gosh, I'm leaving our 6 kids and my husband. What am I doing? And then when I left Hungary, I was crying on the plane because I left a chunk of my heart there. So yes, I would definitely have made it longer.
Heather,
I would have, there's not much I would have done differently. I would have had my family over for longer. So my mother stayed with me for a few months, and my spouse was there for a few months. But if at all possible, I would say Fulbrights are best enjoyed with the people who are close to you. So I'd probably do that.
Donathan?
I agree. I would have made my trip a lot longer. There was so much I still didn't get a chance to do, so extending it from a semester to a year would have been certainly something I would do differently.
Kimberly?
Yeah, I wouldn't have made mine longer because it moves into hurricane season, and so that's pretty scary. And so I had some incidents with, I think, a typhoon or something possibly coming, I don't know. But anyway, are these earthquakes, these underwater earthquakes. So, yeah, 6 months was good, and I'm glad I brought my family, and I was so happy that my parents were able to visit as well.
Great. Courtney?
You know, there are some opportunities that in hindsight I feel that I missed in terms of formalizing the relationship between CANIDA, the Gender Research Institute at USM, and the human rights organizations. You know, I feel like there's some opportunities that, in hindsight, I could have taken advantage of to really set up an infrastructure so that after I left, things would continue, and my role as a facilitator would no longer be required. And I feel like some of that's happening on an informal level, but I think I could have done more. And as an aside, if anyone wants to chat with me separately about this, I'm happy to talk about it. But there was in my particular situation, there was a lot of visa-related stress for myself and my family that the embassy tried to help with. Malaysia in particular during that time was going through some transitions that made things quite challenging. And if there is something I could have done in advance to have a better strategy to cope with some of the visa-related ambiguity while I was there, I think I would have enjoyed myself better. So the visa situation is not to be taken lightly, particularly when you're traveling with your family and depending on the country and the context.
Good point. All right. David?
Well, I was in Moscow for 9 months, and it was extended to 10, and I'm glad that I did stay that long because inevitably one gets the benefits, more and more benefits. I mean, the efficiency of operations goes up. I wish I had engaged with other Fulbright recipients, including people who were teaching English in places like Murom and Irkutsk and all over the country. The Russian program is very large, very impressive. There are many, many people doing all different kinds of things. I met them at a variety of seminars that were held in Moscow, which was easy for me because I was already living there. So I wish I had engaged with them a little bit more because their experiences were somewhat more varied than mine being in a big city.
All right, great. Well, we are nearly at the 3:15 mark here in DC. I want to thank you all so much for taking the time today to share your experiences. I want to thank the audience for tuning in. This is a very exciting time. We have another webinar scheduled next Thursday, August 6th, from 4 p.m. to 5 p.m. Eastern, where you will meet the other half of the cohort. There are 13 ambassadors total, and all regions are represented in terms of geographic world regions as well as disciplines. So please join in for that to complete the experience of meeting all of our distinguished alumni ambassadors. I wish all of those of you that are on the call who are applying this September to, you know, I wish you all the best, and please tune in for our application advising webinars or our office hours. We are here to assist you, and of course our lovely ambassadors are here to give advice as well. So thank you so much. The contact information in general is scholars@iie.org, and again, if you didn't catch the email addresses of our ambassadors, please email me and I'll connect you. Thank you, everyone, and have a wonderful afternoon. Bye-bye.
Thank you.